You may recall that I suggested to you last week that Isaiah chapter 64 is really a prayer. It's a cry to God for revival and for help. Oh, that thou wouldst rend the heavens and come down, that the mountains might quake at thy presence, to make thy name known to thine adversaries, and that the nations might tremble at thy presence. Oh, that thou wouldst come down to make the nations tremble at thy presence. And it's a prayer that reaches its climax in the last three verses, where the prayer asks God to look at the awful mess that the church is in. And he says, now, look at the state of the churches. Now, would you not like to come down and help us and revive your work? Thy holy cities have become a wilderness. Zion has become a wilderness. Jerusalem is a desolation. Our holy and beautiful house, where our fathers praised thee, has been burned by fire. Wilt thou restrain thyself at these things, O Lord? Wilt thou keep silent and afflict us sorely? And chapter 65, which we read this evening, is really the answer to that prayer. But the strange thing is this, that God doesn't answer the prayer by sending a revival. In fact, he answers the prayer by asking questions. And this is what God says in these first two verses. He says, well, you know, it's all very well for you to ask me to step in and to intervene and help you and revive the church. But let me ask you a question, says God. Who respond to me when I speak? And who really listen to my voice? And who heed the message when it is preached? And so, chapter 65, the answer to the prayer in chapter 64, deals in these first two verses with these questions. Who really respond to God's voice when he speaks? Now, I don't want to say a great deal about the catalogue of sins in verses 3 to 7, because this catalogue of sins is really a catalogue of the particular sins into which the church had lapsed in this time. The people had turned away from God, and they had lapsed into the worship of nature, sacrificing in gardens. They were burning incense on brick altars to foreign gods and strange gods. They had turned to spiritualism and fortune-telling and necromancy and the whole world of the bizarre and the demonic. They were, says Isaiah, sitting in tombs and spending the night in secret places, having seances with the dead. They had started eating foods that were prohibited to the Jews. They were eating swine's flesh, and the broth of abominable things was in their vessels. Now, of course, Isaiah is not suggesting that when people fall away from God, they all go as far as that. These are simply the particular expressions of the sins and the backsliding into which the church in Isaiah's day had lapsed. Of course, it's still true that when people turn away from God, some of these things are realities today. It's true that when people turn away from the living God, they turn to nature worship, and they worship the creature rather than the creator. It's true that they burn incense and offer worship to strange gods other than the true and the living God. And it certainly is true that when people turn away from the living God, they take up fortune-telling and seances and spiritualism, and they tamper with the demonic world, the world of the bizarre, the dangerous world of necromancy and luck and fortune. But verses 3 to 7 have a very important message, I think. And the message is this, that when a church departs from the true and the living God, there is no saying where the church will end. And what is true for the church at large is also true for Christians in particular. When a Christian departs from the living God, there is no saying where he will end. After all, when the prodigal son left his father, all he wanted was a bit of fun, the occasional sports car, the odd party, one or two girlfriends. He never thought he would finish up in a pig's trough. When he left his father, he had no intentions of landing up amongst pigs. But it so happens that that was where his sin took him. When Elimelech and Naomi left the promised land in a day of famine, they had no intentions of settling down in Moab, and they certainly had no intentions that their two sons should marry pagan women. But in fact, that was where their backsliding took them. You see, when men depart from the living God, there is no telling where their sin will lead them. This is a point that's well made by the late Professor C.S. Lewis in his very fine sermon called The Inner Ring. And the point of his sermon is to illustrate how we can all be drawn away from the true and the good and the godly and the Christian, and we can be sucked into the inner ring. It's an invisible ring, but it's all the more real because it's invisible. And he gives very vivid illustrations of how people can be drawn into something less than what is right and lawful. And he says in these memorable words, "If you are drawn in, next week it will be something a little further from the rules. And next year, something further still, but all in the jolliest, friendliest spirit. It may end in a crash, a scandal, and penal servitude. It may end in millions, a peerage, and giving the prizes at your old school. But you will be a scoundrel." There's no telling where you will land if you depart from the true and the living God. Now, apart from that message of verses 3 to 7, I think there are two very important messages for Christians here. The first of these lies in the first two verses. "I was ready to be sought by those who did not ask for me. I was ready to be found by those who did not seek me. And I said, here am I, to a nation that did not call on my name. I spread out my hands all the day to a rebellious people who walk in a way that is not good, following their own devices." Now, the really interesting thing is this, that in his letter to the Romans, the Apostle Paul quotes these two verses, and he applies verse 1 as God speaking to the Gentiles and to the pagans and to the outsiders and to the unsaved. And Paul applies verse 2 as God speaking to the church, to the insiders, to those who claim to belong to God. He quotes these verses, there's no need to turn it up, just at the end of Romans chapter 10. And here they are, chapter 10 and verse 20. Isaiah is so bold as to say, I have been found by those who did not seek me. I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. Verse 21. But concerning Israel, God says, all day long I have held out my hands in welcome to a disobedient and a contrary people. And the message of these first two verses in Isaiah 65 is surely this, and it's a message that is testified to by a great deal of contemporary church history. And it's this, that it's not always the church that makes the most eager response to the message of God. Very, very often, church people and people who claim to belong to Christ sit in stony silence, not taking much notice of the gospel and not really responding to Christ, and sometimes not even listening. Whereas when that same message is preached to the outsiders and the pagans and the godless, you often find an eagerness to hear, and indeed an eagerness to be saved. And that's the point of these two verses. In verse 1, God says to the pagans, I was ready to be sought by those who did not ask for me. I was ready to be found by those who did not seek me. And I said to them, here am I, here am I, to a nation that did not call on my name. And then he turns to the church in verse 2 and he says, I spread out my hands all the day to a rebellious people who walk in a way that is not good. And that message, you know, which is rather a solemn and a penetrating message, the message of the unresponsive insiders and the responsive outsiders, is a message that has a long and honorable tradition. After all, Ruth was an outsider. She was a Moabitess. She was a pagan girl from a land of idols, but she turned to God. Naaman the leper was an accursed Gentile. He belonged to the heathen empire of Assyria. He was an outsider, but he turned to God. Uriah the Hittite, by his very name, tells you that he belonged to the ancient pagan empire of the Hittites. He was an outsider, but he turned to God. The Kerethi and the Pelethi, of whom we read in the books of Samuel, were David's bodyguards, and they were Philistines. They were outsiders, but they had turned to God. Very often, the truth of church history is the truth of the unresponsive insiders and the responsive outsiders. And it seems that God has his people in some very queer corners. You know, I find this arresting as a minister of the gospel, that God is not obliged to the church. God is not obliged to church people. And when church people do not want God, and that is sometimes the case, then there are plenty of other people in the world who do want God, even although they have never heard Him. My friend, God is never stuck for converts. God is never stuck for candidates for His kingdom. Let me spell this out in a very clear and practical way, that if we will not have the gospel of Christ in this place, and if we here resist the fundamental messages of conversion and the need for a new birth and forgiveness, and if we here in this privileged institution will not have Jesus Christ to reign over us, and if we will not bow the knee to the Lordship of Christ, do you not think that God could quite easily close this place down and go somewhere else to bless somebody else? Read the Old Testament, and you will find that one of the marks of the Shekinah glory of God, this shimmering pillar which symbolized God's presence and blessing, the Shekinah glory of God, was that it moved. It didn't stay in one place. God is not obliged to pour out His blessing on one place. The glory moves. And when the glory moves, the blessing moves. Now let me give you two illustrations of this from two Scottish churches of the last century. You know, I used to hate history at school. I think it's because it was badly taught. Well, that's one excuse, anyhow. I certainly didn't like it, and I didn't care for the history teacher, which also didn't help. But one of our professors at Divinity College taught me to love history, because he said, history is full of messages. And if you don't learn the messages of history, then you will be doomed to repeat the failures of history. And we in Scotland have a lot to learn from our church history. Let me tell of how God's glory and blessing moved last century from two of the great evangelical churches in Scotland of last century. The Free Church, first of all, which was formed in 1843, when the vast majority of the evangelicals in the Church of Scotland walked out of the General Assembly in 1843. I think it was held in, well, the church that is now St. Andrew's and St. George's, away down George Street in Edinburgh. And they all walked out over the mound and down to the Tanfield Hall. I stand corrected on these facts. And there they constituted themselves as the Free Church of Scotland. Now, on the surface, you see, they walked out because of what was called the Patronage Act. That was an act of Parliament which allowed the local laird, or the local landlord, to nominate the parish minister. And you can hardly wonder at the laird's anxiety to do this. After all, the laird paid the minister's salary. The congregation didn't pay the minister's salary in those days. It was paid by the local laird. I think when this church was founded in 1840 or so, the first minister's salary was paid by the Duke of Westminster. They got him to support the minister of this church, although I'm sure the Duke of Westminster was never in the place. He just sent a check or what have you. Now, on the surface, that was why these men walked out of the Church of Scotland. But that was only superficial. You see, underneath, the real division was the division between the evangelicals, who stood for the traditional gospel message and the Word of God, and the moderates, or the liberals, who believed in just about almost anything. Morality, that was all they believed in. Now, you see, the real tragedy of the disruption of the church in 1843 was that it was so unnecessary. Because if they just held their breath for a wee while, the evangelicals were already beginning to have the majority, and they pretty soon would have had the ascendancy in the General Assembly, and then they could have got rid of this Patronage Act. But Thomas Chalmers, who was the leader amongst the evangelicals, he was pushed on by the hotheads. Thomas Chalmers didn't want to come out and start the Free Church. He was a balanced, quiet man, Thomas Chalmers. But he was pushed on by the hotheads. And so the Free Kirk came out. And there's no doubt about it that from 1843 onwards, God prospered the Free Church. And he blessed it. And the money poured in. And it had to pour in. Because the ministers and their wives and their children, they'd all walked out of the church. They had no homes. They'd no manses, no salaries, no kirk buildings. They'd no livings. They had absolutely nothing in 1843 when they walked out. And yet within years, every village and town in Scotland had its free kirk and its free manse. And then pride came in. And they became proud of their independence. They were proud that they had the gospel and the Alfkirk was dead. They were proud that they weren't parish church. And they became superior. They were proud that they had the gospel and the word of God and they had all the missionaries. And they certainly had, because in 1843, every foreign missionary left the Church of Scotland and joined the Free Church. Every single one left and joined the Free Church. And in their pride and their vanity, the fathers of the Free Church in the middle of last century coveted the higher learning for their sons. They wanted to be superior and give their sons a superior education. And so they sent them to Germany for the superior education. And that's why the Free Church divinity students went to places in Germany like Tübingen. But by that time, they were unaware of it. The higher criticism had started in Germany. The higher criticism which had started questioning the Bible, the reliability of the Bible, the authenticity of the Bible, the trustworthiness of the Bible, the inspiration of the Bible. All of this was being questioned in Germany. And the result was that these students came home to Scotland and they had been poisoned and infected by that critical attitude to the Bible. They still wanted to preach the gospel. They still wanted to be evangelical men in their pulpits. They wanted to preach Christ, but they no longer had a trustworthy Bible. They no longer had an inspired book. They had nothing to stand on. They wanted a superstructure without a substructure. They wanted a building without foundations. And so within 30 years, the Free Church started to die until the Free Church of last century finally died in 1900. And it was the same with that great other evangelical church of last century, the UPs, the United Presbyterians. The UPs had their roots away, way back in Scottish history in several smaller breakaways with the most awful people for fighting each other. You know, the Scots. Oh, dearie me, mention theology and we'll have a scrap with you. Terrible. The UP church, you see, was really a union of several smaller breakaways going way back into the 18th century. Back to the first secession under a man called Erskine, where all the Erskines come from in Scotland. Back to the days of the Auld Lichts and the New Lichts and the Burghers and the Anti-Burghers and the Auld Licht Burghers and the Auld Licht Anti-Burghers and the New Licht Anti-Burghers and the New Licht Burghers. All excommunicating each other. Great fun. Well, fun to us. I don't know what the father thought about it upstairs. And so several of these breakaway groups united and formed the United Presbyterian Church. And what a force for God it was last century. A force for Christ and the gospel. Missionary minded. Message of grace. Teetotal. Very strict. Teetotal. Building mission halls all over the place to reach the poor of industrial Scotland. Mary Slessor was a United Presbyterian missionary. And the United Presbyterians in Inverness were responsible in bringing Sankey and Moody, the American evangelists, to the Highlands for their great revival campaign in 1874. Mercy on my soul, it was the United Presbyterians who brought Moody to this pulpit in 1874. And the same thing happened with them as happened with the Free Church. The pride set in. And they became proud of their gospel, and proud of not being Alkirk, and proud of being living, and proud of not being dead. And they built these vast churches, you know, some of the greatest monuments, the ecclesiastical monuments in Scotland today, are old United Presbyterian churches. Like Wellington Church in Glasgow, or Kelvinside Church in Glasgow. Cathedrals! It was a mistake that the Free Church did. I was having lunch with Hugh Ferrier last Tuesday, and he lamented the fact that the Free Church evangelicals built cathedrals, and now they're saddled with these vast cathedrals that they have to spend fortunes on to keep wind and water tight. And so the UPs started to die, and the Shekinah glory moved on. And God ceased to bless the Free Church of last century and the UP Church as he had in past years. And the blessing of God moved on. I was ready to be sought by those who did not ask for me. I was ready to be found by those who did not seek me. And I said to them, here am I, here am I. To a nation that did not call on my name, the glory had moved. And to the church, God says, I spread out my hands all the day long to a rebellious people who walk in a way that is not good, following their own devices. And you know, that's a lesson that is permanently true of the churches, that when Christian people in the churches are professing Christian people in the churches do not respond to the challenges and the exhortations of ministry, then God passes them by and God goes somewhere else to the outsiders with his blessing. The second great lesson in this chapter is from verse 8 onwards. And it's the lesson that there is always a remnant. The remnant in verse 8 is compared to a bunch of grapes. And it looks at first sight as if they'd all been crushed and the juice has all gone. But God says, as the wine is found in the cluster, and they say, do not destroy it. Don't throw it all away. There is still a blessing in it. So will I do for my servant's sake and not destroy them all. I will bring forth descendants from Jacob, and from Judah I will bring inheritors of my mountains, and so on. At the heart of the great conglomeration that is the visible church, the historic church, at the heart of the visible church, there are those who belong to God. And as I pointed out in the reading, the people who belong to God are called by all sorts of names here. They're called my servants, in verse 8. They're called the descendants and the inheritors of Jacob, in verse 9. They're called my chosen, in verse 9. They're called my people, in verse 10. They're called my servants four times in verse 13, verse 15, my chosen, my servants in verse 15, and so on. And these are very important verses because from this time onwards in the history of Israel, you find rising to the surface one of the most important of all Christian doctrines, and it's the doctrine of the remnant. Sometimes it's spoken of as the remnant returning from Assyria, or it's the remnant returning from Babylon, or it's the remnant returning from Persia. Right through the Old Testament, you get the idea of a church at the heart of the church. And that's an idea that pushes itself right into the New Testament, where you find it in Paul's teaching in Romans 2, where he says that not everyone who belongs to Israel is an Israelite, and not everyone who belongs to the Jewish nation is a true Jew, and not everyone who is in the church is a Christian. There is a real church inside the big church. And it's an idea that pushes itself outside the Bible, right down, just to speak about our own history, into the covenanting times and the distinction that the covenanters made between the visible and the invisible church. The visible church is the church that you see with your eyes. It's made up of pews, hymn books, people, names, houses, addresses, communion rolls, baptismal rolls, all that sort of thing. That is the visible church. But at the heart of that visible church, there is an invisible church that belongs to Christ. And that invisible church is the remnant. The Scottish forefathers in our covenanting days called it the remnant called according to the election of grace. And I'm very intrigued looking up the scriptures just to see how early the idea of a remnant is found in the teaching of Isaiah. In fact, it's found in the first chapter of his book. One or two references just while we go on. Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 9. I have them all in chronological order. We won't read them all because that would take too long. He says in Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 9, right at the start of his ministry, very famous words, he said, "If the Lord of hosts had not left to us a few survivors, then we should have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah," both of which, of course, were completely annihilated. There was nothing left of Sodom and Gomorrah. He says, if there hadn't been a remnant, then the whole nation would have been destroyed. The reference is there, of course, to Abraham praying for Sodom and Gomorrah. And you remember he started with numbers. Was it 50? He says, if there are 50, Lord, will you destroy? He said, no. If there are 45, will you destroy the cities? No. If there are 40, 35, 30, and he came down. Didn't he stop at 10, something like that? Some people feel that he should have kept going to see if there was a big enough remnant in Sodom and Gomorrah to save the city. You see, if the remnant is big enough, it saves the city. Just as in churches, if there's a big enough Christian remnant, God saves the church. God is saving churches in Scotland today because of the believing remnant at the heart of the church. If the Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, then we would have become like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. In chapter 10, the idea of the remnant again rises to the surface. Chapter 10 and verse 20, speaking about being rescued from Assyria, but being capable of a wider application. Isaiah 10 and 20, "In that day the remnant of Israel and the survivors of the house of Jacob will no more lean upon him that smote them, but will lean upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel in truth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though the people of Israel be as the sand of the sea, however big they are, only a remnant of them will return. Destruction is decreed for the bigger nation, bigger church, But it's a destruction overflowing with righteousness for the smaller church, for the Lord of hosts, will make a full end as decreed in the midst of the earth. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, for although the people of Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them will return. And lastly, in Isaiah chapter 11, moving on, chapter 11 and verse 10, in that day the root of Jesse, that's Christ, shall stand as an ensign to the people. Him shall the nations seek, and his dwellings shall be glorious. And in that day the Lord will extend his hand a second time to recover the remnant which is left of his people from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, from Ethiopia, from Elam, from Shinar, from Hamath, and from the coastlands of the sea. He will raise an ensign in Christ for the nations. He will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And so on, right down through the book of Amos, right down through the book of Micah, right down into the teaching of Jesus, right through the teaching of Paul, and so on and on and on. The message is that at the heart of the visible church, there is an invisible church. And at the heart of this vast conglomerate, a mixture of believers and unbelievers, and every church nowadays is that. Every Christian church today is a mixture of believers and unbelievers. It's a mixture of converted people and unconverted people. It's a mixture of people who are saved and people who are not saved. It's a mixture of people who are once born and people who are twice born. But at the heart of the mixture, at the heart of the conglomeration, there is a remnant. There is life for the remnant. There is peace for the remnant. There is favor for the remnant that stands at the heart of the visible church. Now, could we just look for a second in closing at what the Puritans had to say about the visible and invisible churches. You know that the Westminster Assembly produced three documents. There was the Westminster Confession of Faith, which is pretty heavy stuff, really. Excuse me. Somebody said that they used it before they invented sleeping pills. It certainly sends you to sleep. If you can't sleep at night, read the Westminster Confession. If you're feeling a bit tired, it'll send you right off. It's pretty heavy going. But the Westminster Confession of Faith says, you know, in its introduction, if people find this a bit heavy, then there is a longer catechism. If your understanding is slightly limited, you know, you read the longer catechism. Well, that's a good sleeping tablet as well, because it's pretty heavy. And it says, for those of limited understanding, you read the shorter catechism. And if you want to see what they expected of those with a limited understanding, you read the shorter catechism. Here's the longer catechism on the visible and the invisible church. You don't read it all. Just a few questions. Question 61. Are all they saved who hear the gospel and live in the church? Answer, all that hear the gospel and live in the visible church are not saved. It's a mixture. But they only who are members of the church invisible. What is the visible church? The visible church is a society made up of all such as in all ages and places of the world do profess the true religion and of their children. That's to say, communicant roles, adherent roles, baptismal roles, all of that is the visible church. Question 64, what is the invisible church? The invisible church, which is at the heart of the other one, is the whole number of the elect, the chosen, who have been, are, or shall be gathered into one under Christ the head. What special benefits do the invisible church enjoy by Christ? Members of the invisible church by Christ enjoy union and communion with him in grace and in glory. What is that union which the chosen have with Christ? The union which the chosen have with Christ is the work of God's grace, by which they are spiritually and mystically and yet really and inseparably joined to Christ as their head and their husband. And this is done in their effectual calling. And lastly, 68, are the elect, the chosen only, effectually called? All the elect, and they only, are effectually called, although others may be and often are outwardly called by the ministry of the word. You know, this is the answer to people who come forward at evangelistic campaigns and make decisions for Christ, and then in a few weeks that it's all gone. You see? They have been moved by the word. They've been drawn to Christ. But a permanent work hasn't been done in them, and have some common operation of the Spirit, who for their willful contempt and neglect of the grace offered to them, being justly left in their unbelief, do never truly come to Jesus Christ. One of the early fathers used to speak about ecclesiola in ecclesia, a little church inside the big church. And the practical message of Isaiah chapter 65, verses 8 onwards is this: you must constantly keep asking yourself what church you belong to. Are you just part of the vast, broad thing? Is your name just on a baptismal roll or a communion roll? Is your name there and it's just a nominal thing? Doesn't really mean very much to you. Or do you belong to the remnant, the hidden church, ecclesiola in ecclesia, the Lord's church, my people, my servants, my heritage, my chosen? So, to which church do you belong? That's the question. Amen. May God add a blessing to his word. To his name be praise and glory. We sing the first three verses of this communion hymn, 323. Now the time is rather gone, and if you feel that you have to go off, it's perfectly in order if you slip out quite quietly during the singing of this hymn. It's now 7:45 by this very erratic clock in front of me. If you do have to rush off to a meal in a hotel or to some other meeting, then don't be ashamed to slip out during the singing of these three verses of hymn 322. Of course, you're welcome to stay for communion if you wish. Hear, O my Lord, I see thee face to face.